Welcome everyone to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 80, section 9, which is old single column, page 897. Okay, a final section in this paper. They've had extensive discussions about how Europe came to be populated, basically at the beginning of recorded history, and even took us a little bit deeper in, because obviously our records about what was going on in Europe don't go back as far as what was going on in Mesopotamia, say. And so they actually took us forward a few more millennia from 6,000 or 5,000 BC. But like I said, they've given all of the basics of how you ended up with roughly a certain kind of racial stock in the more northern parts of Europe, and a certain sort of racial stock in the more southern, very Mediterranean parts of, coastal parts of Europe. And then, as we just got the final details about at the end of the preceding session, you can see that they're in section 8, they're talking about the Danubian Andonites. They gave us the rest of the details about how you have relatively extensive amounts of Andonite stock penetrating from the east into Central Europe up the Danube Valley. And for those of you who don't know, the Danube cuts basically east-west, it's inclining to the north as you go to the west, but, basically cuts through the center from east to west, through most of Europe, right up to, almost to the Rhine, so in other words, almost to the eastern border of France and, and the western border of Germany. Okay, so you get this wedge that just of a different racial stock that has a lot of Andonite, inserted into the middle of Europe, and so you end up with these three different flavors, at least way back in Europe, not super distinct from one another, but relatively distinct. And that's what they want to review now in this final section. As you can see from the title, section 9, they want to just give a little thumbnail sketch of each of those three quote-unquote races. In other words, roughly distinct racial stocks, various flavors blended in to a mixed race in kind of three different ways. Okay. And in the process of reviewing that, they're going to address not only the early recognition of that fact that was happening in the beginning of the 20th century, as intellectuals, scholars, scientists were beginning to basically recognize that threefold Europe racial nature. So they're not only going to kind of speak to that recognition, but they're also going to address the false tangents that humans ran off on, relative to that information, over the course of the 20th century. And and then bring it very much again to a direct reminder of why this is very relevant now, you know, in a way beyond mere historical information. Why is this significant to the fundamental reason there is a fifth epical revelation, that there's a civilizational emergency? How does this immediately, again, address that fundamental issue? So that it's trying to give us a heads up on what we need to be clear on, what we need to have the courage to face, what we need the wisdom to deal with. Okay, so let's see what they have here for us. And you'll see that in the process of getting these little thumbnail sketches, they sort of pick up a couple of loose ends that they left behind along the way in the preceding sections. Okay.
Section 9, the three white races. The racial blends in Europe toward the close of the Andite migrations became generalized into the three white races as follows. 1. The northern white race. This so-called Nordic race consisted primarily of the blue man plus the Andite, but also contained a considerable amount of Andinite blood, together with smaller amounts of the red and yellow Zingic. The northern white race thus encompassed these four most desirable human stocks, but the largest inheritance was from the blue man. The typical early Nordic was long-headed, tall, and blonde. But long ago, this race became thoroughly mixed with all of the branches of the white peoples.
Okay, why don't I just address that final little sentence there. Notice before they get, into it very far at all, at the end of the first kind of full big paragraph, they throw in a little qualifier, right? Because they know what's about to happen in the 20th century if people going off on false tangents with this, and thinking in very existential terms about what was called the Nordics, the Alpines, and the Mediterraneans. Like I said up front, I mean, yes, if you go back to say 3000 BC, you have a rough distinction into these three groups. But it was already beginning to blend quite a bit. Now, and 5000 years later, or 4500 years later, say, it's blended a lot. And you can't base your relationship to Europe on some false belief that there's these very definitive, north-south differentiations of the people there. Okay, so you can see they're already tempering the problems of the 20th century about these issues. But obviously, as you can see from the title of the section, like I said up front, they are saying, okay, those people who were thinking in those terms, yeah, they may have been oversimplifying, okay, but they weren't utterly false. No, there's a definite true predicate for those thoughts about kind of quote-unquote three European races. Okay, it's not totally devoid of validity. Okay, so let's look at the specifics. And so as we see how they're summarizing, we know that you had that blue man there that already was blending in some Neanderthal Andonite when he got to Europe 300,000 years ago. So that the Andonite stuff that they're talking about is getting blended in very early on, and they're interacting with Andonites in the peripheries all the time. So that blending of Andonite kind of is happening over the whole span. But in come Andites. Well, maybe we should remind ourselves before any Andites came in there in the very early days. Remember, we had some Adamite, some Adamic blood that got in there and gave us the Cro-Magnons. You know, that sort of upstepped blue man mixed with Neanderthal, right? So that, you know, a lot of times when they're saying blue man, there's all those details. But, okay, eventually you get to where you have genuine Andites pouring in there in great numbers. And you had a little bit of red and yellow that got blended in very early on, even before all the peoples left Central Asia, you know, there was some blending. And so you end up, like they say there, with four most desirable human stocks. You've got all three primary Sangiks. Yeah, I mean, a lot of it's blue, yeah. I mean, the blue, red, and yellow aren't in equal measures, but you've got all three primary Sangiks, and you've got a whole bunch of Andite. And then you've got a little bit of pulling down with Andonite. And it's not that Andonite isn't human. It's just, you know, we all know it's just that pre-Sangic, very limited human. So, you know, you blend in too much of it, and it kind of bogs down the people in terms of sort of leaning into the future and being a very progressive people. They kind of slow down and sort of rest on their heels. Okay. But there was so much Andite that that's not a huge issue. Even though there was a relatively significant amount of Andonite. Even that Andonite in the very early days, it had some backmating blended in, like we've talked about. And actually, all of that, the backmating, fair amount of Andonite. But there's so much Andite. So in the end, it's not critically limited.
When you say backmate, I always think they're backmating with primates.
Again, they're backmating with those near human stocks that, you know, a lot of which, you know, archaeologists have discovered. You know, we're existent down in Africa and we're drifting up into Europe. A lot of those ape-like lines, you know, were evolving too. I mean, there was this vast parallel process of stocks evolving towards will creatures. The ones that made it, you know, those immediate precursors to Andon and Fanta, you know, those are totally separate from what was going on, say, in Africa. And in very short order, they went from a very, you know, relatively primitive lemur-like animal, you know, boom, 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 to will creatures. But you had these other stocks that were on these very long tracks, you know, for millions of years, you know, unlike with Andon and Fanta's line, for millions of years, they're just slowly moving closer and closer to, you know, human level. Going so slow that line that led to Andon and Fanta, boom, it got there. Okay, then the adjutants change, and all those species that were moving towards humans are not moving towards humans anymore. But a lot of them got quite close. Biologically, they're compatible, right? They don't have the sixth and seventh adjutants, but you can mate with them. You can procreate with them, right? They're very similar biologically to humans.
What do you think they look like?
You know, relatively upright, hairy, you know, creatures, you know. Like I said, you know, that's why Europeans end up with a lot of body hair a lot of times, right? That isn't there in the Andon and Fanta's stock and the Sangiks that follow from them. I mean, they were all relatively hairless, right? The primary human stock, so... You know, the fact that we ended up with some peoples that have a lot of body hair again, that's because of that, those bringing in those other stocks. And so you can say, well, that's unfortunate. But they say, well, yeah, okay, there were some negative things from that back meeting, but there were some positive genetic things in those other stocks. So it wasn't all bad, that back meeting. It brought in some positive things. As long as you have enough Adamic blood to kind of eventually make up for the being, you know, drugged back by the back mating, the negatives will get left behind in the long run, and the positives that were there will get utilized. Now, unfortunately, we didn't get as much Adamic blood as we should have, so it ends up being kind of a mixed bag. But it's kind of a lot like the malignant bacteria and viruses on the planet. Again, the life carriers were disturbed that you ended up getting as many of those things happening as did when they loosened the constraints on this decimal world. But again, well, when all is said and done, it won't matter because Adamic blood will, you know, will lift us above that biologic assault. And you know, so you know, we got a little bit. We aren't as susceptible, but you know, right. So it's a mixed bag. You know, you have a similar thing, and so we're just going to have to work through that. We're going to have to take some negative with some positive, and do our best to work, you know, in spite of that. Okay, but anyway, back to
delightful
the
delightful pets, man. They were delightful pets.
Back to the points here. You see them, you know, like the largest inheritance, like we were saying, is the blue man, and then, you know, just like the humans were talking about it and thinking about it at the beginning of the 20th century, the so-called Nordic race, right? They're basically long-headed, tall, and blonde. In other words, they have enough Adamic blood, basically through the Andites, that you can get a lot of height above 6 foot. You can dilute the skin darkness and color down to, you know, where it basically is all washed out and it's kind of sort of white. Okay. And the Adamites and the Nodites, you know, they get blended into the Andites, they were both long-headed. And so you have, so even though some of the other stocks, like especially the Andonite, is broad-headed, not long-headed, there's so much Andite blood, right, that in the end, you end up something that's, in general, long-headed, tall, and blonde, because all of the evolutionary stock, be it Andonite or Sangic, because, of course, the Sangics come from the Andonites, all of that evolutionary stock has black hair and black eyes. Right, because the only pigment is melanin, right? You know, which means "quote unquote" black, right? Right. So, just the very fact that you can take—see, we're, you know, everything is black hair, black eyes, but you can end up with something that is not, right? That has light hair and light eyes. That's how much Adamic blood, you know, and Nodite blood, got into that mix. I mean, so much so that it could, become completely, you know, basically completely dominant over those evolutionary genes that are wanting to make black hair and black eyes, right? You know, you always have that dominant recessive sort of a thing, but it's relative. And you know, here you've got so much so that you can actually make traits that are relative to Sangics that are dominant traits. You can make those recessive. You know, they end up on the bottom.
So much for all the dumb blonde jokes.
Right. No,
the darkies came up with that.
Okay. So, right. So, you know, you. Until you get to the last sentence there, right? You're starting to, you know, if you know anything about the beginnings of the 20th century, the first couple decades of the 20th century, and then of course what happened subsequent to that with how the Nazis picked up on some things and ran off on tangents with it, right? You're just going, oh boy, I don't know about what they're saying here, right? It's like, well, no, okay, there's some facts, okay, you know, like the fact that this is enough Adamic blood that you can actually suppress a lot of the evolutionary stock, you know, characteristics. So it's not as much as there should have been. You know, we don't let anything go to your head about this, right? But it's enough that you know, you've got them relatively long-headed, tall, and blonde. You know, or by blonde, of course, that's just kind of, it means they're brown hair, red hair, or blonde hair, right? It's not black hair.
Okay. Hitler had black hair and black eyes.
Right. We all know, you know, how there's a selective zeal, you know, when you start playing with some of these things amongst the Nazis and the other fascists. Okay. But nonetheless, okay. Okay. So that's, you know, there's obviously a lot of potential there, like they're saying, when they say four most desirable human stocks. That doesn't necessarily mean that the actuality back then was very profound, but there's a lot of potential, right? You give evolution some time with that potential, you know, and something significant can come out of it. You know, if it doesn't do the Abel, as in Cain and Abel, right? Doesn't do the Abel thing and do itself in before the potential has a chance to actualize. But there is a potential there. Okay, what else do they say?
The primitive culture of Europe, which was encountered by the invading Nordics, was that of the retrograding Danubians blended with the blue man. The Nordic Danish and the Danubian Andenite cultures met and mingled on the Rhine, as is witnessed by the existence of two racial groups in Germany today.
Okay, so so you establish this northern white race, but they don't just sit there because they've got a lot of directionality. You know, they're leaning forward. So they are going to start working their way southward, and that's what they're referring to. And you know, you could just picture it. You know, if the center of that Nordic culture is in what's now Denmark, you know, is in Jutland. It's pretty obvious that they start moving south, they're going to go right down the Rhine. Right? It's just right there. So, you know, so they're going to be penetrating down the Rhine, and you get down a ways, and you know, you basically have the Danube coming from the east right up to it. Okay? And so they're obviously going to start coming into contact as they head southward with yet more Andenite stock. You give it enough time, and even more Andenite sea is going to get blended in. But as they point out, even with a lot of blending, because of the ancient predicate, like, you know, say 3000 BC, because of the ancient predicate, even today, you have a differential between northern and southern Germany. Right? You've got the more Nordic, long-headed peoples, the Plattdeutsch, in northern Germany. And you have the more round-headed, right, the more broad-headed you know, peoples in southern Germany, more in the higher, you know, the more alpine-like regions of Germany instead of the coastal plains up in the north, right, the more alpine stuff in the south, the Hochdeutsch, you know, Hoch for high in altitude, right? Right, you have that differential between the Germans in the lowlands and the Germans in the highlands, the plot. Deutsch and the Hochdeutsch. Okay, and that's what they're talking about. And, you know, stemming from those ancient times, right, there's going to be a strong tendency for the, you know, as they're calling it the Nordic Danish, right, since the Dane is the nucleus of it, for that those peoples to be conquering and ruling. But as time goes by, eventually the other peoples in Europe start to take more and more issue with this and can do something about it and start to turn the tables on the northern white race. And, which German is basically the standard German in Germany now? The German of the northern Germans or the southern Germans? Yeah, the southern Germans, right? I mean, standard German now is basically Hochdeutsch, not Plattdeutsch. So you can see how over time, right, those who are kind of being ruled, you know, push against the being ruled and take the reins themselves. You know, so, you know, in past centuries in Europe, there's a lot of turmoil as a lot of that stuff got reversed, you know, and the long-standing dominance of that Nordic stock, you know, got overthrown. You know, in relatively recent times, you got some of that injected into Normandy, you know, establishing Normandy and the Normans, and that sort of spread out and kind of reestablished the ruling class in Europe, you know, all stemming from those Normans, in other words, those Nordics. And so you did get kind of a resurgence of that Nordic rulership again through the Normans, but again, you know, we're seeing that being challenged, you know, at least in an evolutionary fashion where monarchies are falling out of, you know, being, you know, in full monarchical rule, you know, and they're becoming more figurehead sort of thing. So those Nordics are figureheads and, you know, and the other peoples are, you know, the prime minister or whatever. Okay. Or at least have the potential to be. Okay, so I just, you know, if you're not familiar with the history of Europe, the fact that they're back in, say, 3000 BC, you do have these three races, that has a lot to do with how things have played out, what kind of wars there's been, and who's hated whom. But anyway, way back then, when the Nordic peoples are coming down and meeting the Alpine peoples, you know, initially along the Rhine there, and stemming from there, it's not, they're not going to be in a very warring mode, as you'll see in a second here. The Nordics who seem to be taking a kind of a long-term, we'll just, when Thor defeated the Blue Man in the Somme Valley, okay, we kind of, you know, made our point militaristically. And now we're just going to kind of let the slow evolutionary process lead to our eventual kind of dominance in the whole continent. All right, so what else do they say here?
The Nordics continued to trade in amber from the Baltic coast, building up a great commerce with the broad heads of the Danube Valley via the Brenner Pass. This extended contact with the Danubians led these northerners into mother worship, and for several thousands of years, cremation of the dead was almost universal throughout Scandinavia. This explains why remains of the earlier white races, although buried all over Europe, are not to be found, only their ashes in stone and clay urns. These white men also built dwellings. They never lived in caves. And again, this explains why there are so few evidences of the white man's early culture, although the preceding Cro-Magnon type is well preserved, where it has been securely sealed up in caves and grottos. As it were, one day in Northern Europe, there is a primitive culture of the retrogressing Danubians and the Blue Man, and the next that of a suddenly appearing and vastly superior white man.
Before I get into all the intriguing details there, just reminded me, I forgot to pick up that point. They said it again, retrogressing Danubians, you notice there, okay? That's what I was hinting at up front. Retrogressing in relative terms in many ways. I mean, again, because if you have a lot of Andonite, that's just not a very progressive people. Right, and so it's, you know, they're blending into the Blue Man like they're saying there, okay, it's pulling back, it's a drag on the people kind of leaning in and being a progressing people, so they're retrogressing because they're not very progressible relative to, you know, the much more Andite stocks, okay. You know, they're not full on degenerating because of back mating, not that kind of retrogressing. Okay, not that severe. Okay. All right. Okay, so you can see that once, like I said, once they really had made their point militaristically, yeah, the Andites, relative to the Blue Man, they started shifting into a commerce mode. Okay, and the first thing they say there, they start you out. I'm up at the Baltic coast. Okay, that makes sense. And then they throw you a seeming curveball. The Brenner Pass, huh? I mean, if anyone knows Europe, I mean, the Brenner Pass is between northern Italy and Austria, right? Through the Alps. You're going, wait a minute. I thought I was up in the Baltic region. What am I doing clear down in northern Italy now? Remember that I told you we had a loose end that would get picked up. Remember when they told you about how there were some Andites that came in, from Africa to Spain and across the south and ended up there in Switzerland where they were meeting other Andites coming from the Aegean, into Italy, right? And we talked about that, right? Okay. So you think about these Nordic peoples penetrating down the Rhine. Okay, I mean, you're penetrating all the way to Switzerland, and right, and so in other words, you kind of, because it got seeded in northern Italy there with some more Andite, it becomes this kind of southward extension of the Nordic peoples in northern Italy. Okay, so they're kind of coming down and wrapping around. Right, and then they're going back up through the Brenner Pass, like they're saying there, and engaging the Danube Valley. Okay, so that you're setting up, kind of see the northern peoples, kind of are staking their claim down into northern Italy there, and then re-engaging the Andonites northward, right, into Austria and southern Germany, for instance. Okay, so that's what's going on there, and that just re-emphasizes what they said back there when they mentioned Switzerland, that you go all the way forward to the middle, roughly the middle of the 20th century with the Nazis and the Italian fascists. Right, and all of these ideas about Nordics, Alpines, and Mediterraneans, regardless of what Mussolini might have been, literally racially, right? He keys into that and that fact that there is a genetic differential north-south in Italy. Just like you have in northern and southern Germany, like we were just talking about, just like we saw in many places, northern and southern China, northern and southern India, right, et cetera. In the 20th century, you definitely had a lot playing out, no matter how much it might have been kind of been just a matter of fiat declaration as opposed to being literally factual, but nonetheless, they were playing out, we're better than you because we're part of northern Italy and you're part of southern Italy, okay? But it isn't all made up is what they're reminding us. There is at least an ancient historical predicate, right? I mean, like I said before, I mean, it's not a coincidence that Venice is in northern Italy, right? And it played such a huge role in the Renaissance and stuff like that, okay? That potential that we've been talking about eventually starts to actualize, even if it gets, quite confused. There's a huge potential there that eventually gets awakened by the evolutionary process, and you can have a born-again event in human history that is the Renaissance. Yep.
Something that I think makes Europe kind of confusing, at least for me, is I think of the Andonites as being pushed to the to the Alpine regions.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, but when you think of Europe, you don't think of these people in the Alpine regions, Switzerland, Italy, and southern Germany, as being...
Again, because this is a long time ago. That's what I was trying to stress, you know, and as they stress. I mean, a lot has changed in the last 5,000 years, okay? I mean, you know, this, as they started out here, you know, when they talked about the invading Nordics there, right? I mean, they started invading, you know, 5,000, you know, 4,000 years ago, right? And eventually... there's a lot of their cultural dominance, you know, and sort of, you know, we all, like you're saying, we all know there's regions that are quote-unquote geographically alpine, but don't have some sort of limited culture. They have a very, you know, very progressive sort of culture, right? Because, the northern stock, that Andite potential... you know, at least became the dominant cultural influence in those regions, if not, you know, genetically, you know, quite dominant in those regions. Yeah. So, but you know, we have to kind of throw ourselves back to a time that you can't go and observe right now, when you had that whole wedge in the middle of Europe, where there's a very predominant Andonite stock, and the Andites are just going around them. They're not conquering them. They're just working around them and leaving them be for a long time. I mean, they left them be long enough, even with, you know, natural racial mixing and, you know, blending and stuff. Right? You can get to the times of the beginning of the 20th century when they're talking about, you know, Nordics, Alpines, and Mediterraneans, and, you know, you can easily find peoples in Central Europe that are going to be just like what they're about to describe, you know, and people can notice that. It's like, well, that's just not Nordic. That's different, okay? That's broad-headed and, you know, and whatnot, okay? You know, and there's more of them in Central Europe than there are in Southern or Northern Europe, even though there's some in both places. Right, there's a higher percentage still, even in the beginning of the 20th century, even now, right, of that broad-headedness in the middle there. Even if long ago culturally it's not a, a central white race culture. Okay, yeah, from way back then. All right, okay. The other things there. Let's see. So we got that confusing thing about the Brenner Pass. And then remember, they're picking up that issue that they were mentioning at the end of the preceding section about how you had mother worship filtering up, and the Danubian Andonites getting evangelized too and picking up on this from those evangelists from Crete of the mother cult. And so then the mother cult gets drug up deep into Europe, up the Danube, and eventually you've got the Nordics interacting with them, and they take a fancy to those ideas, and then you've got all of the northern peoples cremating and themselves and stuff when they die. Okay. So what started with fixation on how only Eve was Cain's super parent, right? The beginning of the mother cult. It's gone all the way from those Nodites to the east of Mesopotamia, all the way up, you know, into Scandinavia. And then, like they mentioned, you don't have the cave and grotto thing, you know, and so you've got simple dwellings that, you know, are long gone now. So that's why there's almost no archaeological stuff to find up there, despite the fact that it goes a long ways back. They're just, you know, it's just a kind of a huge archaeological gap that's, it's not going to be filled in by even more investigation, any more digging. There just isn't anything really to dig up, okay? And so, you know, it's a great thing that the revelators have given us that so we can fill in that blank that we can't fill in ourselves. Let's see, what else do we have? Okay, yeah, I guess we got everything there. Anyone have any questions about what the issues are there? Yeah?
I have a curiosity. Cro-Magnon and Niagara Falls.
Mm-hmm.
So, in mainstream, they teach you that they're communicating through grunts and stuff like that. So, what's the language? Do they communicate?
Oh, sure. I mean, all those people, those are humans. They aren't animals, you know. I mean, they have a language. They,
like, I remember that the Andonites had a language.
Yeah, I mean, all humans have language. That's, you know, I mean, that's what it means to be human. I mean, some, you know, there's some fancy animals that can communicate, but they don't have language. Uh-huh. See, and that, and, you know, the important thing is to not blur those two together. You know, language is something that comes down through your encirclement in the Holy Spirit. You know, and if you're talking about something that doesn't, that isn't that, you shouldn't be calling it language. Okay? That's what the word language refers to, is what our connection to the cosmos and how that's coming down into us from above. You know, as opposed to just a bottom-up complexity that is communicating in some way, you know, interacting in some way.
So the animals, they interact, they can understand us, and they can react to us of what we're telling them to do.
Yeah, I mean, again, they use their second adjutant. They know when you make a certain sound, which you know to be a certain word, but of course they don't know it as a word or a concept or anything, but they know that when they hear you make a certain sound, they associate that sound with some fact, like jumping or rolling over or whatever, right? You know, the second adjutant allows them to connect the dots between a certain sound and a certain thing they're supposed to do or not do, right? They have a second adjutant. They can put two and two together like that. But they have no consciousness about what this all means or anything, right? You know?
Yeah. Charlie, my dog, he starts at a certain time during the day when it's time for him to have his second meal.
Mm-hmm.
He comes up and he starts going like this, begging, you know?
Right. They have memory and they've got this all laid out. They know what time of day, you know, a certain thing happens and they anticipate that, you know, in that sort of mechanical sense. You know, they don't have foresight or anything like that, but they just... But they know, because of well-worn memory, that at a certain time of day, right, that's associated with a certain fact. The second adjutant is connected that time of day with eating or whatever. Right?
I thought that they didn't have a sense of time.
Yes, yeah. Well, they don't have an objective sense of time. They exist pretty much in the moment, but they have memory. Right, they have a past and a present. They don't think of it like that, right? But you know, they.
They sure don't know a daylight savings.
Right, but
they're sitting there an hour ahead of time.
Yeah.
That'll be a bummer.
I mean, just think about a very simple an insect creature, and how much they're synchronized with the hours of the day. And it's like, they have no concept of any of that at all. You know, it's all just instinct. You go, well, how could they do anything like that if they're so limited? Well, remember, it's the creative Mother Spirit's mind. It's not like whose mind it really is a limited person. Don't judge the mind functioning by that limited little point of expression. I mean, don't judge me by my the the tip of my pinky. There's a lot to me, than that little tiny fingernail, right? No matter how much fancy things that little, that my pinky tip might do, right? I can tap and do all kinds of things with it, right? That's because, that, it isn't all just in my fingertip, right? It's connected back to a brain anyway, right? But in a bigger sense, right? It's connected to a mind. And that mind, even goes beyond me. Right? There's a lot of things that I just do because that's the way agitant mind functions. I don't have to sort of choose. I certainly don't have to choose. I don't even have to really decide or anything. It just happens.
When you gotta go, you gotta go.
Right? And you go, well, why does it just happen? Well, isn't it mind made and universe and personality managed the entire universe? Yeah, see, the reason that mind can just seem to function on its own, because it's not really on its own, it's a being's mind, right? It's the, in the case of our local universe, it's the creative mother spirit's mind. The agitant mind functioning is her thoughts, as it were, and it's her doing. The third adjutant is the energy of loyalty, not because somehow a certain kind of energy is kind of just magical unto itself and is quote-unquote loyal. It's part of her, right? She has the quality of loyalty within her mindedness, and she's sharing that with a dog, for instance, right? It's really she that's loyal rather than it, the dog, right? When all is said and done. In the same way, most of my loyalty is not really my loyalty. It's her loyalty. See, and that's the whole point.
Right.
Yeah, that's his point. See, the whole point is, right now I'm pretty much just a drop of water in the ocean. Right? I need to get it so that eventually it's literally my loyalty, not hers, that's manifesting, right? That I've individuated myself. I've used my free will to begin to separate, my mindedness, the functioning of my mind from her functioning, right? So that it's my free will loyalty as opposed to just what happens naturally because it's of her loyalty. Okay. That's the whole point. And eventually you have to even transcend the entire mind womb of the finite, right, of the universal mother. Eventually you're going to stand separate from that as an absentite being, right? Because you've chosen to be all those things, not because you get them naturally from the Supreme, but because you've chosen to be those things unto yourself. And you're not dependent upon the Supreme anymore. For some really fancy things, obviously, at that point, you embody those things within yourself. And that goes on and on and on and on and on, right? Eventually, you'll stand separate from the ultimate one, the ultimate Father. You'll be a co-absolute being, right? And you'll be out of that ocean. You'll no longer be dependent upon the natural functioning of that vast absentite ocean.
It'll be a while.
But see, that's the whole point. You start out just completely natural, right? And it's not really you doing anything, right? It's the mother that you're in the womb of that's really doing everything. And you, the Father, though, gave you a potential to eventually see how she does it, and to do likewise separate from her. Right? The Father gave you that potential to separate yourself from that mind womb, right, and stand on your own.
Be perfect.
Yeah.
But the animals can't stand.
And the animals, because the animals, they have no free will choice. They're just innately part of that. And it's it's her functioning. It's So it's not like it's a lowly function. It can be very, very profound, very significant. Okay. All right, so back to this. Let's see. Okay, so I guess we got everything. I think we did. So that's the northern white race, or the so-called, you know, Nordic race, as it was described at the beginning of the 20th century. What about a little thumbnail on the central group here?
Two, the central white race. While this group includes the strains of blue, yellow, and andite, it is predominantly andinite. These people are broad-headed, swarthy, and stocky. They are driven like a wedge between the Nordic and Mediterranean races, with the broad base resting in Asia and the apex penetrating eastern France.
And so like we talked about, you see, you got the Danube going right up there, almost to the Rhine. And so obviously they can fan out from the end of the Danube, the headwaters of the Danube there, and penetrate into, just into France, and like they said, north a little bit into Belgium, what's now Belgium. But that's basically it. They flare off the end of the Danube there, and then they're getting surrounded by the northern white race. And northern white race is kind of going around them, see, rather than conquering and taking over that region, in a militaristic fashion. Okay, and so here we see that it's, those peoples that are funneling up the Danube, those aren't pure Andinites. I mean, they're bringing some blue and yellow, and of course some andite, because the andites are all over. But it's a much, much greater percentage andinite than the other peoples. So much so that you're kind of, when all is said and done, just like we saw that despite all the blending, you ended up with kind of long-headed, tall blonde, or light-haired, light-eyed. Here, when all is said and done, you end up with broad-headed, because that's andinite, no matter how much andite, blue, yellow, whatnot is. You end up with broad-headed, swarthy. In other words, that's melanin, because swarth means black, basically, right? Like German schwarz, for black. Right, so that's the melanin, right? You end up basically with that swarthy complexion. It's going to be a tendency for darker eyes and hair too, and stocky, because again, like I've said, in order to start to get, especially if you look at the whole body form, right, nothing to do with fat, nothing to do with obesity, to get that a more angular sort of body form, has to come from andite. Right, all the sangic, all the evolutionary stock is more rounded, right, in terms of its, the care, the nature of the body, the basic form of the body. But the thing that should strike you there is the fact that they said swarthy. Remember what they said in the preceding section when they were talking about the Hittites? They're in Asia Minor. And they said their pale skins and broad heads were typical of that race. In much closer to Mesopotamia and Adamsonite territory, right? Much closer to that andite sort of homeland region, you can have something that can have a lot of andinite. But can be pale skin. But these that are heading up the Danube, see, they're telling you, no, that's less andite, so that they really don't have pale skins. They've got swarthier skin. So in the beginning of the 20th century, when they're looking for alpines, in contrast to Nordics, right? They notice, this guy has a swarthier complexion. Right, than a fair-skinned Nordic. And that's, see, that's because of that greater Andonite. It's not because of, you know, their skin isn't darker like that because of, say, Saharan peoples, you know, the more secondary Sangic stock coming up from Africa, like you might initially think, you know, it was giving them a darker skin. That's the Southern Europeans that are getting some darker skin because of that. But those Central Europeans, it's just because there's so much Andonite in that basic darker melanin skin. Okay. All right. We got everything here. Keep going.
For almost 20,000 years, the Andonites had been pushed farther and farther to the north of Central Asia by the Andites. By 3000 BC, increasing aridity was driving these Andonites back into Turkestan. This Andonite push southward continued for over 1,000 years and, splitting around the Caspian and Black Seas, penetrated Europe by way of both the Balkans and the Ukraine. This invasion included the remaining groups of Adamson's descendants and, during the latter half of the invasion period, carried with it considerable numbers of the Iranian Andites, as well as many of the descendants of the Sethite priests.
Okay, so we're going way back, those early things we were talking about when basically everything was in Central Asia, and the Andonites were getting shoved way up, north, towards Siberia and stuff. But going way back to that, and then you have the increasing aridity, so. It's driving them southward, and as they sweep both, across the north of the Caspian and Black Seas and across the south of the Caspian and Black Seas, sort of wrapping around towards the delta of the Danube there, they're sort of sweeping up a lot of those peoples. Because it's not a super fast process, and so you're blending with those, and as they're pointing out, so a lot of that other stock that they mentioned at the beginning, that's in the central white race, was kind of picked up in this flow, right? A little bit of Andite, right? The remaining Adamsonite stuff, it was sort of just picked up in this flow around the two big lakes as it headed west, and then went up the Danube. Including you can pick up some of that. Remember how they mentioned the blue and yellow? You can pick up some of that as you go through the Near East there. Okay, so like they're saying there, some of them are going around the south way, and so then they come up through the Balkans to get to the Danube. And some are going the north way, and so they're going through what's Ukraine, the Ukraine now, and wrapping down. Let's see, anything else there? Like I was saying, it's don't think of this as happening super, super fast. Like they were saying, the Andonite push southward continued over 1,000 years. See, so just them kind of getting back down to Turkestan is over 1,000-year span. So this is, they're not sweeping like Andites on horseback around the big lakes and coming in. They're drifting around. That's why I said they're picking up all this stuff, because they're drifting around. And then they drift up the Danube into Central Europe. All right. Okay. And again, we keep seeing how they're taking us more recent than 6,000 BC. We got this 3,000 BC and things like this. They're bringing, like I said, they have to give us a little bit more detail about Europe after 6,000 BC because we don't have the recorded history. Okay.
By 2500 BC, the westward thrust of the Andonites reached Europe. And this overrunning of all Mesopotamia, Asia Minor, and the Danube Basin by the barbarians of the hills of Turkestan constituted the most serious and lasting of all cultural setbacks up to that time. These invaders definitely Andonized the character of the Central European races, which have ever since remained characteristically alpine.
Okay, so the fact is that they throw in that word barbarian. See, that's, when they were, using that expression, retrogressing Danubians, before. All right, that a lot of that very primitive human stock, of that Andonite stock, all right, that puts a big drag on the progressing nature of the culture. Okay, and so it's going to be difficult for those people to be pushing into the semi-civilized range. They're going to be kind of stuck back in a more barbarian sort of level of society and culture. Not savage, okay, not that primitive, right? But it's not going to be very fancy, and it's not going to want to advance forward very easily. And so they're reminding you of how there's a lot of influence in Europe, just kind of dragging things back to a more tribal sort of mentality, and the founding of the United States was supposed to be in contrast to such back retrogressing sort of thought, to try to be leaning forward and try to leave behind that more barbarian sort of, that more natural tribal mentality about things, including religion, right? And pushing forward. And, and if we start falsely exalting Europe, it's like, oh, we should be progressive like them. No, that's retrogressive. Right? You see movement and you're assuming that movement is forward. No, that's flowing backward by material gravity. And a lot of it is literally just because there's, that more primitive human stock just puts a drag, and it falsely exalts more primitive cultural notions because it feels appropriate. To someone who's more primitive, it seems evil to do those things that a more Andite people want to do. And it seems good to do the more natural barbaric things. And you flip them around and call the lesser the greater, right? In your relative rationalization of things.
Are you saying that the Europeans and the Scandinavians are more backward than the Americans?
Well, it's not... you can't generalize like that, but see, even not back here where we're reading, obviously, but in the last 1,000 years, a lot of the more progressive-minded Northern European peoples, because they're more directional sort of peoples, they wanted to go somewhere, and there was some place to go. North America, and so they went. And it left behind, the people left behind in Scandinavia, not totally, but percentage-wise, they're a lot more of a place-like people. They're a lot more susceptible to arguments from other peoples that, the old, ways are really the right ways, and that newfangled leaning into the future stuff, that's not appropriate. See, so you can take someone who, in many ways, is genetically, in terms of like their height and their skin color or something, might seem like they ought to be a very progressive people, and they may talk in a very progressive way, but, they may like to use that word, for instance. But if you watch what they're actually thinking, they're thinking pretty place-like. They're not very direction-like. They're not really leaning into the future. They're starting to bog down. And like I talked about before, that's definitely the case with Norway and Sweden. Not as much with Denmark, because that always was the seat of the genuinely more progressive genetics there, the more future-oriented genetics there. And so you can still find Danes, willing to kind of lean into life a little bit more than the Norwegians and the Swedes, because most of that leaning into life stock in Norway and Sweden came here. That's why I have Norwegian heritage, right? Because, you know, a few generations back, those people came from Norway and ended up in Minnesota and then in North Dakota. You know, those people that didn't want to just, you know, my relatives that are still back there, like the ones in near Bergen in Norway, I mean, they're living in the same house that's been lived in for over 1,000 years. Right? It was originally a sod house.
So it's paid off by
now. Yeah, it's paid off now. Well, kind of, sort of, because the walls are now 6 foot thick. Right, because in the middle is a sod wall, and then every time there was a new building material, you know, that was invented, they put that on the inside and the outside, and so, you know, the wall has gotten really thick now, and now with fancy outside, you know, modern siding on it, you know, and some fancy, you know, like sheetrock interior on it, right? But, you know, so they had to kind of repay for it every time they rebuilt it, basically. But they didn't tear down the old, you notice. See, like a more genuinely progressive people would do, right? Instead of reverencing the past like that, it's like, well, we can't tear down the sod. I mean, it's like sacred sod. So we got to leave it in the middle of the wall. You know, so, you know, eventually, you know, this room that used to be quite expansive, you know, barely fits a bed now because the walls are 6 foot thick. Okay. But you rationalize around it. See, that's the thing. I mean, and it, you know, it has its positives and negatives. I mean, they're not going to be very militaristic because they don't have a very directional sense. Okay, so that has its positives. But that can also become a negative. What if you come under attack? You know, the golden rulers will be exterminated by these baser orders of humanity that, you know, are attacking them. If you don't have a very militaristic sense about yourself, or if you really think, you know, I've been around a long time, it's maybe time for me to just fade from, you know, from the pages of history and let someone else take, you know. See, that, you know, a very Andite people don't think like that. It's like, no. All right? No, I'm pushing forward into the future, and I'm not going to go quietly into the night. And I may have to take up arms to do that. Right, it's easier to get the Danes to take up arms than it is to get the Norwegians or the Swedes to take up arms. Right, and see, and that isn't purely a negative thing. Right, it's not in the grand scheme of things. If the golden rulers don't allow themselves to be exterminated because they fight back, that's a good thing because they're the only golden rulers on the planet. And if they think so little of themselves that they won't defend themselves and let themselves be exterminated by barbarians, right, is mankind going to progress? No, mankind is going to fall back into a very primitive state, and it's going to take thousands of years for evolution to slowly find the potential and actualize it again, right?
Did Jesus say resist not evil, or was it just in the Bible?
Well, see, the key thing there is you can overcome evil with goodness, but you can't overcome sin with goodness. And Jesus never said you can overcome sin with goodness, because you can't. You can overcome evil, because evil's basically a passive fact. It can be overcome by the positiveness of goodness. Sin is active. Sin is, I know damn well what the difference is between good and bad. You're not going to overcome me with goodness. I know goodness when I see it, and I know badness when I see it. I'm choosing badness purposely. And someone who's choosing badness, you know, eyes wide open purposely, you can't overcome them with goodness. They're actively rejecting goodness. So unless they change their mind, you're going to have to do something with them.
Rehab.
Right? You're going to have to fight back. If you're in that mode. But anyway, that all seems like it's maybe tangential, but it's not. I mean, that's what we're building up here. We're trying to get an understanding of what it takes to keep civilization going, what some of the genetic facts are, so that we aren't delusionally exalting things that shouldn't be exalted. You know? We need to recognize the lesser. You don't demonize the lesser, but, you know, you don't think that God loves the lesser less, right? God doesn't distinguish between lesser and greater. God's love is absolute. It has nothing to do with God's love. It has nothing to do with their spiritual nature. But physically, you know, and especially intellectually, mentally, right, lesser has to be recognized, and it can't be, you know, thought of as greater or just as great. Right? It's lesser. And if you follow the lesser, your ends will be lesser. If you want greater ends, you have to follow the greater. That's just the way it is.
Absolute, does that mean it can't be dissolved? Salute?
Yeah, right, yeah, yeah, it's not...
I'm just guessing.
Yes, exactly, you're guessing the etymology, yeah, correctly, right, it's... there's no relativity, so see, it can't be dissolved by something else, right, it can't be absorbed into something else, right, it stands integrously in the face of that which would make it relative, that would dilute it, that would degrade it, that would downstep it, that would, you know, lessen it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so back to what we have here. So the thing about, you know, see them bringing in the 2500 BC, remember how we kind of talked about that before when we were talking about India? Remember how, you know, that final Andite-Aryan invasion of northern India was happening in the middle of the third millennium BC. So, you know, why? Why were those Andite peoples, you know, headings, you know, basically southeast from Central Asia and ending up in northern India there? Because you had all these Andite barbarians streaming around, and it's like, okay, we're out of here, okay? Right? And so they headed to India. It's all happening at the same time. That was sort of the last big rearranging of where people were. And again, you can see it has a lot to do with climatic change, you know, why people are going from point A to point B.
They're calling them Andonites, and they may be predominantly right. Andonites.
Yeah.
They are not primitive Andonites.
Right.
They are aggressive.
Exactly. You know, that's why, you know, when they say, you know, you notice you had the Nordic Danish, you know, so that they're Nordic with a Danish nucleus, right? You know, as it were, you know, the Jutland, you know, location Danish nucleus, and they call them Danubian hyphen Andonite, right? Yeah, you have a mere Andonite foundation, right? But it's modified with all this other stuff that's added on that are the peoples that went up the Danube. Right. A modified Andonite, you know, as it modified in those peoples that went up the Danube. That's the modification. See, in both cases, they used a geographic, you know, qualifier in two different ways. One, it's the addition on top of a foundation, and the other, it's the foundation. The Nordic Danish, the Danubian Andonite, the geographic location is the second word in the first one, and the first word in the other one. See, okay. So yeah, but it, you know, in just using the geography to indicate the peoples that ended up in that geographic location, right, have this significance. Okay. All right, so what else we have here? Let's see. Okay, yeah, so we talked about the 2500 BC. So, definitely by 2000 BC, remember how that came up way back too? I mean, definitely by 2000 BC, things are quite, you know, in place. You have the Babylonians in Mesopotamia now, right, for instance. And, you know, all the Andite stuff is just gone. All that stuff, like they're saying, it's just, that third millennium BC was the final rearranging of everything, and then begins kind of full on recorded history from 2000 BC forward. Okay, so that's the central white race, or the so-called alpine race. And you notice they use that right at the end, characteristically, capital A, alpine, right? Not just of the Alps, right? But, yeah, the alpine race, in other words, so-called alpine race. Okay, number three.
Three, the southern white race. This brunette Mediterranean race consisted of a blend of the Andite and the blue man, with a smaller Andinite strain than in the north. This group also absorbed a considerable amount of the secondary Sangic blood through the Saharans. In later times, this southern division of the white race was infused by strong Andite elements from the eastern Mediterranean.
Okay, so right, that was just a reminder of what we've kind of gone through. Notice they're stressing that you've got all these different things that are in play, but when all is said and done, you've got a brunette people. In other words, you have black-haired people. Remember, brunette don't think of that as brown hair. That's black hair. Okay. Right, you've got the classic Southern European brunette. And, you have all those complexities of the people being driven out of the Sahara and coming up there, like we've talked about many times. And then that final little tidbit, we were even referring to that a little bit when we were talking about northern Italy and Switzerland. You have some Andites coming into southern Europe, through the Aegean, like we talked about. So you have those coming in and giving a little bit more Andite to southern Europe, coming in from the east, and then those ones that came around through Spain, so a little bit more Andite coming in from to southern Europe from the west. And so when all is said and done, even though it started out kind of biased away from a lot of the Andites, since that was all going into northern Europe, in the end, it ends up with a reasonable amount of Andite, it isn't hopelessly place-like in southern Europe. But we all know who invented the siesta. It wasn't the Scandinavians, okay? All right, see, who has a little bit more of a place-like tendency, right? that's just the natural state that they're not going to be leaning into the forward direction quite as aggressively as the northern Europeans, at least way back, foundationally. Okay?
The Mediterranean coastlands did not, however, become permeated by the Andites until the times of the great nomadic invasions of 2500 BC. Land traffic and trade were nearly suspended during these centuries when the nomads invaded the eastern Mediterranean districts. This interference with land travel brought about the great expansion of sea traffic and trade. Mediterranean seaborne commerce was in full swing about 4,500 years ago, and this development of marine traffic resulted in the sudden expansion of the descendants of the Andites throughout the entire coastal territory of the Mediterranean basin.
We've talked about these issues some, but never really talked about what was all behind it, and that's that whole bit about those Andinites coming down from way up north and going through Central Asia again. And so it just upset all the normal trade routes, now had barbarians, that would rob you, if you tried to travel those old land routes. So it literally drove commerce out into the sea. But the Andites, who you know, they're not going to be thwarted. It's like, well, okay, so if you're going to mess up all the land stuff, well, then I'll build ships and I'll take to the sea. I'm gonna be a commercial people. You know, I'm leaning into things. You know, I'm inventive. I'm even creative. Right? And I'll figure out a way to get to the ends that I desire. And so it ended up, see, like we were just talking, pushing some Andite blood around the shores of the Mediterranean, both in Europe and Africa, that wasn't there until these quite recent times. So the southern white race kind of becomes the southern white race, you know, a lot more recently than the northern white race became the northern white race, right? Because you just didn't have enough Andite to kind of overcome, you know, like all of that Saharan stock that was there and stuff, and right, until you got these final little spurts of Andite injected into that region. Did you have a question? Okay. All right. So again, you can kind of see that, you know, if you want to sort of get everything rearranged, and not even 3000 BC quite does it. You kind of need to get to 2000 BC to have everything pretty much as you can extrapolate backward to and kind of understand. Okay, let's see here. Anything else there? I think we got it all there, didn't we? Yeah, let's keep going.
These racial mixtures laid the foundations for the Southern European race, the most highly mixed of all. And since these days, the race has undergone still further admixture, notably with the blue-yellow Andite peoples of Arabia. This Mediterranean race is, in fact, so freely admixed with the surrounding peoples as to be virtually indiscernible as a separate type. But in general, its members are short, long-headed, and brunette.
Okay, so a lot shorter stock, you know, the brunette thing we've already talked about. Remember that a lot of that secondary sangic, see, reinforces the long-headedness. The secondary sangics were medium to long-headed, the primary sangics were medium to broad-headed. Okay, so even though you have a lot of that secondary sangic, it isn't making the heads end up being broad like a lot of Andonite does. Okay, so that sort of adds to, you know, like I said, the way the rationalization went, you know, with Mussolini and crew in Italy during the Second World War times. Since they were so fixated on the long-headed, broad-headed thing, even if you weren't sort of in full Nordic mode, at least you were long-headed and you were more acceptable. So, or you could rationalize yourself as being, I'm basically Nordic. And you can play off of a north-south Italian differential that was there, but not as, you know, extremely there as some of the very, very Nordic peoples way up in Scandinavia, obviously.
You mentioned Arabians having yellow.
So I was going to bring that up because remember how they mentioned with the central white race, while this group includes strains of blue, yellow, and Andite. And here, you know, you're like, well, blue, yellow, and Andite. Well, yeah, see here, blue, yellow, Andite peoples of Arabia, you know, way, way, way back, you know, in the early days of the Sangics, you ended up with some blue, yellow mix peoples that kind of hung in that basic region. So you're drifted a little bit to the southwest, okay? And so, yeah, those Arabian peoples, like, for instance, that were constantly assailing the Mesopotamians from the west, I have a lot of blue and yellow man in them. And obviously they pick up andite. A lot of times they just mentioned some of those blends of sanghics in passing. But there were a number of different blends that went into different regions. It wasn't as simple as, well, the red all stayed together and they went here, and the yellow all stayed together and they went here. Yes, we told those stories, but there were a lot of all the different ones that didn't really go far afield. They kind of stayed in that region. They blended together in different ways, and moved little distances and stuff and ended up being like, the Arabian stock or whatnot.
So the long-headed and the broad-headed,
mm-hmm.
way back when, was it more exaggerated?
Obviously, if you go to a pure Sangic peoples or, pure violet race, whatnot, I mean, you have the very definitive expressions of those, but no one, is pure stock anymore. So it's all complicated. But they're mentioning it here because, they're saying, okay, it isn't just a totally false Nazi fixation to run around with calipers and measuring people's, cranial dimensions. Okay. There's all kinds of, spectrum variation to it, including, the peoples that obviously the master race wasn't thinking of highly, very dark secondary peoples, secondary Sangic peoples, right? You can think of a lot of Africans that are quite long-headed, right? Yeah, because those secondary Sangics tended, some of them tended to quite long-headed. They're just pointing out you've got those differences in the original stocks. They lay all this stuff out in the next paper. But you have those basic differences, and if you end up with a predominance of a certain stock in a region, like if it's predominantly andonite, okay, no matter how much long-headed stock is blended in, if it's predominantly broad-headed andonite stock, it's going to end up being basically broad-headed peoples.
What about those... They've found skulls of these people that have this real long.
Yeah, and then of course there's peoples that did things to to their bodies, bind their bodies in various ways, and alter skull shapes, and them doing neck rings and stretching necks out long, and platter, you can bind heads, you can bind feet, you can do all kinds of things.
You can't make it grow.
Sure, you can. Right, you can just right. I mean, if you start, your cranium when you're very young is very soft, right? The baby couldn't get out of the birth canal if the cranium was still pretty soft, right? You can sculpt growing bone. Bone is still growing right now. I could get my teeth jerked out and get teeth screwed in, and the bone will grow around the screw in my jaw. Bone is can easily be, even when you're quite old, be molded to a certain direction.
I thought that maybe it was an aliens.
No, it's just, people can, can take on various fixations. You can ask an interesting mythological sort of question of what would, was the inspiration for them doing a certain thing. Right, it could come from some curious influence, but nonetheless, it's humans get fixated on a certain morphology, and they just see to it that their body grows that way.
Where are you headed?
Yeah. So to speak. Notice the thing that they were saying, because it's so blended in Southern Europe, from so many directions, your you're using race very loosely now, right? You know, thinking of it in some monolithic fashion. But when all is said and done, no matter how complicated it was in Southern Europe and Central Europe and Northern Europe, there's a basic difference in the three regions. And so a Southern European is, you know, significantly different than a Northern European, you know, in general terms. You know, even though you might be able to hunt around in Southern Europe and find someone, it's like, well, I don't know, how can I distinguish that from what's up in Northern Europe? That looks pretty darn similar to me. Right? But it's a bell curve, right? And they're just basically pointing out, no matter how broad the bell curve might be, there's three bell curves where the centers are offset from one another. Lots of overlap because of all the blending. But the centers of these three bell curves are not on top of each other, right? Okay, so you have a basic threefold European stock. Okay, what else do they have to tell us here?
In the north, the Andites, through warfare and marriage, obliterated the blue men. But in the south, they survived in greater numbers. The Basques and the Berbers represent the survival of two branches of this race, but even these peoples have been thoroughly admixed with the Saharans.
Okay, another little interesting tidbit to throw in. Because the Andites started in the north and were definitively moving southward, but then won the Battle of the Somme, and then it was more just commerce and kind of drifting and, you know, southward, you ended up, when all was said and done, with a couple of areas that had relatively more blue, right? Then that blue didn't get quite so much other stuff added in on top of it. So you have kind of a little bit more of a Cro-Magnon kind of a stock, okay? Both, you know, their the border between Spain and France, right along the Atlantic coast, the Basques, and then in northern Africa with the Berbers. Okay, now obviously, there's going to be that final thing. They both have been thoroughly admixed with the Saharans. Obviously going to be even more so with the Berbers in Africa. But with the Basques, even though you have a lot of blending, the one, you know, and you could even pick up on some of the genetic differences between the Basques and others, because there hasn't been quite so much other stuff, you know, blended in on top of the Cro-Magnons like it was in other areas. But the thing that immediately stands out with the Basques, that isn't such with the Berbers, is the Basque language. The Basque language is not Indo-European. It's not Finno-Ugric, right? It's not Andite. It's not Andonite. What is with this Basque language? This language that sort of stands all on itself. Well, you can answer that right now. It's like, oh, that's basically Blue Man tongue. Right? That was enough Blue Man there that they're actually preserving a language that has a lot of Blue Man mentality to its construct. Right? It's obviously not going to be pure Blue Man tongue, right? But it's going to be more of a Blue Man tongue than anything else. Okay, that's what the deal is with the Basque language, this mystery that, you know, linguists have about what's up with Basque. Okay. Yep.
Yeah, you know, I've studied the Basques a little bit, and what's interesting about them is their bloodline. Their blood type.
Mm-hmm.
There's more. I'm A negative. Okay? Well, they have the most A negatives.
Yeah, and I
than
think
any other.
Yeah, and I think they don't have it basically any B. Isn't that right? If I remember correctly, I don't think they have much in the way. I don't think they have any B type, basically.
That's
Yeah, see, so again, you can see the genetic. And you can do genetic studies in a number of ways, not just blood, you know, type stuff. But in a number of ways, you can see there seems to be kind of something a little bit more ancient about the genetics. And, you know, this is why. See, there's not so much of the newer Andite genetics piled on top of it. So it's a little bit more of an ancient Sangic-like genetics. You know, and I don't claim to understand how the blood type stuff fits into all the races and stuff, but nonetheless, you know, you can definitely, you know, there's some obvious genetic things, but you know, anyone can see what's right on the, you know, on the surface with the language. What is the deal with the Basque language? See, and it's because of Blue Man Tongue. All right, so that kind of, that's the last of the little tidbits they throw in. So, see, when all is said and done, you can basically go all around Europe, and you can, you know, you can take what they've said in the book. It's like, okay, I basically understand what's up with this area, you know, why maybe it's totally blended in genetically now, but why does this little area have this cultural difference, you know, from other areas? It must harken back to a certain racial difference there that was there for a long time. And you can basically put the pieces together now with what they've given you.
Chris.
Yep.
Is Cro-Magnon a human stock?
Yes, definitely. Okay. Yeah. Remember, you basically have that Neanderthal Blue Man stock upstepped by Adamic stock to give you Cro-Magnon. So it's, you know, I mean, it's got pure Adamic stock blended into it. It's definitely human. Okay.
And Neanderthal
is human.
Okay.
Okay. Right. I mean, those are wild creatures. I mean, the only exception is, remember, you've got over hundreds of thousands of years, the Neanderthals were back mating some. So there were some strains of so-called Neanderthals that weren't really kind of Neanderthals anymore. You know, some of them were so degraded they were actually subhuman. You know, they were so backmated. But, you know, when Blue Man came in, he killed off most of the, you know, those. And then when the Andites came in, they killed off, you know, a lot more. You know, they were more discriminating. You know, it's like Blue Man might have thought that creature was okay, but no, that creature is, no one's going to mate with that thing, okay? You know, Blue Man definitely would have killed off subhumans. Andites would have killed off very limited humans, right, to improve the racial stock, you know. Because they know how this works. You hang around someone long enough, and you're going to mate with them. So the only way to prevent the unfortunate genetics from getting into the gene pool is to just get rid of them.
That was supposed to be your path.
It's just, So anyway. Let's see. Okay. What, yeah. Okay. That's right. So we're basically, yeah. We've got, like I was saying, we, you know, they've laid out all the details. So now they just have a couple of other little tidbits to throw in here for us.
This was the picture of race mixture presented in Central Europe about 3000 BC. In spite of the partial Adamic default, the higher types did blend.
Okay, so they want to just make that one little statement, you know, and like I said, you could say 3000 BC or you could say kind of 2000 BC, all right, back in that time range, you basically have everything set, and when all is said and done, Adamic stock got blended into evolutionary stock, right? You know, so that's, they want to make that just that final little statement. I mean, set aside all the details and whether they might be so-called positive or negative or whatnot. When all is said and done, Adamic blood got blended in here, there, in all kinds of different ways. It got spread around. Okay? And so, again, no matter how limited it might be, say in 3000 BC or 2000 BC, because a little bit of Adamic blood got spread a long ways and diluted a lot, the actuality might not be that great. But there's a potentiality there. And if you give the evolutionary hand long enough, it will take that faint flicker of genetic potential and blow on it gently, and eventually, thousands of years later, it will ignite and will begin to manifest, right? And it's again, the value in something is its potential, not its actuality, right? And so, real greatness, right, can lie unseen, dormant, you know, latent in that potential, that real value for a long time. Okay, now let's, like I said, let's get some more details here.
These were the times of the New Stone Age overlapping the oncoming Bronze Age. In Scandinavia, it was the Bronze Age associated with mother worship. In southern France and Spain, it was the New Stone Age associated with sun worship. This was the time of the building of the circular and roofless sun temples. The European white races were energetic builders, delighting to set up great stones as tokens to the sun, much as did their later-day descendants at Stonehenge. The vogue of sun worship indicates that this was a great period of agriculture in southern Europe.
Okay, so for instance, that little tidbit, you know, what you know, results in something like Stonehenge. Remember I've mentioned you can kind of sort of in root Andite territory, like Mesopotamia terms, you know, the Bronze Age begins at about 3500 BC. Obviously, as you spread out, the more Andite peoples are kind of going to be synced up with that. And, you know, so that in, say, 3000 BC or, you know, or 2500 BC, they're definitely going to be Bronze Age. But those that aren't so Andite are, you know, going to be trailing behind, and they're still kind of going to be, you know, Neolithic and, you know, not quite to the Bronze Age yet. Yep.
When you think of moving big stones,
yeah,
you know, it's nice like people, that stone is immovable.
It's, yeah,
only someone who's energetic and,
yeah,
is thinking in a different way that thinks that it's even possible to move that big stone somewhere.
Yeah, yeah, especially if it isn't just, you know, something simple like you got stones laying here and let's pile them up. That's one thing. But if the stone is way over there and you got to come up with a whole technological scheme to get it over hill and dale, right, to build Stonehenge, yeah, right, that takes a lot of directional sort of sense of self, right? So,
some purpose.
Yeah, yeah, you got to be, you know, very very directed along the line and. Yeah, creativity and all that sort of stuff, right? Yeah, inventiveness and, yeah. But, you know, they're just, you know, pointing out how it all is just kind of predicated on the simple notion of agriculture and sun worship, right? And, you know, and the imaginative mind, the slightly spiritualized mind, takes that into all sorts of fancy fixations, you know, like all the effort it took to build Stonehenge, right? You know, just to sort of give proper reverence to your inner passions about how wonderful it is that the sun, you know, makes your plants grow. Right? And you want to say thank you, right? you know, go to great ends to do it. All right.
So did this, yep, kind of bronze appearance... there was a lot of iron work going on, but that
kind of
got lost.
Yeah, see, remember, that's the sort of thing that you're seeing. It, you know, as the more we blend, the more that having andites with doing iron stuff, you know, that fades away into the evolutionary background, right? You know, and eventually it's all the evolutionary Stone Age, you know, and then slowly gets evolved kind of all together more, you know, up to the Bronze Age and up to the Iron Age. But like they're pointing out, the more Andite peoples are going to be on the leading edge of crossing those thresholds, right? All right. Yeah, and also you can, you know, you can see how they're the later day descendants at Stonehenge, you know. So in other words, Stonehenge doesn't go back to 3000 BC. Right? It's yeah, so you know, like 2000 BC or whatever. And you know, that's you know, they know that there was stuff going on at that location, say back at 3000 BC, but they know the actual big stones that are there right now. Those were set up, you know, down the road a ways. But there were lesser stones, you know, were being set up all over the place, you know, all over Northern Europe there. So that's because of sun worship agriculture that all those stones are being set up all over the place. Okay.
The superstitions of this comparatively recent sun worshiping era even now persist in the folkways of Brittany. Although Christianized for over 1,500 years, these Britons still retained charms of the New Stone Age for warding off the evil eye. They still keep thunder stones in the chimney as protection against lightning. The Britons never mingled with the Scandinavian Nordics. They are survivors of the original Andonite inhabitants of Western Europe mixed with the Mediterranean stock.
So there, you know, you have Brittany, that little tongue poking out, you know, into the Atlantic Ocean there, that little nook that, you know, as they're pointing out, obviously Andonites were shoved into that little nook, you know, up against the Atlantic Ocean for a long time. And so even when you, you know, have genetic blending in and they aren't, you know, really Andonites there anymore, you know, and even when you get centuries of Christian influence and all that, old traditions continue on, right? And you have a tendency to want to be more lastingly identified with the Stone Age, with the Neolithic, you know, the New Stone Age, as they're saying there, with the Neolithic. And you know, notice it's Bretons, it's not the Britons, it's the Bretons, because it's the ones in Brittany, not the British. But if you're not familiar with the whole Thunderstone thing, that, you know, it wasn't until very recent times that sort of those superstitions were finally overcome. You know, as they're pointing out, it actually isn't that far back that you had Stone Age people, you know, at least Neolithic people. But how quickly mankind forgets. So you don't have to go very far forward. And, you know, you're in the Iron Age and you have iron plows and stuff and you're plowing your field and this hand axe, for instance, or this arrowhead gets turned up by your plow. And you're going, what is this magic thing? You know, it must be a thunderbolt, right? Oh, wow. Right? You know, they don't know what the heck these thunderbolts are, and they've decided that this must be what comes down from the heavens, right? And it got embedded down in the earth, and I just flipped it up with my plow, you know, and it becomes this sacred fetish sort of object, right? It's just a hand axe or an arrowhead or something, right? That's the majority of what these thunderstones were Stone Age tools that they were unearthing. And no one had any clue that it was just an arrowhead, right, or a hand axe. They just totally forgotten Stone Age technology. And so they become these things, these magical objects, you know, going to ward off the evil eye. Or obviously, if it's a thunderbolt, if I stuck it in my chimney, I mean, this already is one of those things that's come down from the heavens. It's not going to come down there again, Right? See, so you're trying to prevent lightning from hitting your chimney by sort of like putting the thing that comes down there already so nothing's going to come down there again, so lightning doesn't strike twice, see? So those beliefs, I mean, it wasn't until kind of the full-on impact of the Enlightenment in the 19th century that finally got, you know, most, you know, peoples on the planet in Europe to stop believing that. I mean, even when you, even when they started exploring and found Stone Age peoples, you know, and brought this stuff back, it's like, no, these things aren't thunderbolts. Look, it's, these people are still using those. Those are arrowheads, right? And it's like, no. I mean, they, you know, no, this is a magic thing that came down from the heavens. It took a long time for people to not put the old wineskins, right?
So if your house got hit, you had one of these in your chimney.
Well, obviously, you know, that's a sign from the heavens that you are apart from God in some way. You've done something wrong, right? We all know, right? We all know that these superstitions just set you up for more rational, yeah, need to rationalize, and you know, or you know, it convinces you that you've got some issues, that you've fallen out of favor with God in some way, or you know, why is God punishing me like this? You know, what have I done? I did all the things that I, you know, that are supposed to work, and yet I still suffer. Right? And usually it's the parents speaking of their children. You know, God, why? What did I do to deserve such a child?
So, going back and not setting us off track. I don't know which way we're going.
Yeah.
But and be patient because I don't know exactly how to word it. So I understand evolutionary stock.
Mm-hmm.
But terminology. What is the opposite? So you have Adam.
Right. The Adamic stock.
Adamic stock. Now, to me, that's not evolutionary.
That's the not evolutionary stuff.
And it's the only one.
The Noddite, you know, the prince's staff.
Right.
Started out as just the evolutionary stock of the Andonites, but over those 300,000 years before the default, that genetics was modified. So the Noddites were not fully evolutionary. They were a little bit evolutionary and a little bit not evolutionary.
Gene, explain that a little bit.
But you know, an asterisk that you have to consider. I mean, basically, you have the Sangiks and the Andonites. That's evolutionary stock. The colored races and the original Aboriginal peoples, those are the evolutionary stocks. And then the non-evolutionary is the descendants of Adam and Eve.
So then that's the terminology as non-evolutionary.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I wanted to know.
Yeah.
And how come the Noddites aren't mentioned in any of these?
Because most of what we're talking about here is just, see, the Andites. So the Noddites and the Adamites have already blended together and blended with some evolutionary stock and become the Andites. Yeah. Let's see, did we get everything there? I think so. Yeah, so that's, anyway, that's the, and, you know, maybe just one other little thing to throw in there. You know, if a people do have some memory of, you know, the literalness of Neolithic things and ideas, it's always been believed that the older notions were the more powerful, right? So, you know, that's always in play, that if you feel like, the new religion, yeah, I believe my new religion is powerful, but you find that you still suffer for some reason, then the idea is humans always had, okay, I need to go back to an older belief, because the older it is, the more powerful it is. That's always the belief. So, you know, like with Greek mythology, you have the Olympian gods, right? But you go back to the previous generation, and they're bigger and more powerful. And you go back, right, the generation before that, and they're even bigger and more powerful. Okay? That humans have always thought that way. So, yeah.
Falsely feel that that's
right. Right. Yeah. Like yeah. Yeah. All right. So that's always, you know, in play. And so, you know, this, if it smacks of ancient, you know, it's going to be powerful, and people try to use it as a charm or whatever. Okay.
If you go into the store right now, like I kind of have a new house, and I put a few new things in it. Almost everywhere you go, everything is very primitive. It's drums and it's just everything. It's just a reminder of
the trend. Yeah. It's the way we naturally think. And so if you don't counteract that, in one way or another, you will think that way. That, you know, you will think, well, yeah, a drum set is cool, but if I want to be really powerful, and I want to be quote-unquote spiritual, I need to go back to bongos. Yes.
But the antique roadshow is kind of fun.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay.
Maybe it's because we
know.
Right, yeah, that's just a natural way we think.
And we feel a stability or something.
Yeah,
false stability.
Right.
And it's placed like we want it to hold
right,
on
right.
to
that. Yeah, all those things. It's comfort thought, right? Go back to roots. Go back to foundational things.
That's how I feel about my church.
So, exactly. That's it. That's
it's
just
the oldest, and I feel like it's it's.
See, just recognize that's just the natural child of God mode of thought. So to get to that adult of God state, you have to, you don't demonize the old, okay? But you just recognize you can't. You acknowledge it for what it is. Don't falsely exalt it. Right? It's a beginning, but it's not an ending. Right? Appreciate it as the wonderful beginning it is. Don't falsely exalt it as an ending.
You don't have to keep the sod in the walls.
Yeah, you don't have to keep the sod in the walls. Yeah.
Evolutionary process or something.
You don't have to hang on to all the dying languages or whatever, right?
They talk about that about Christianity.
Yeah, yeah, all those sorts of things. It's just to not be so evolutionary. Okay.
But it is a fallacy to presume to classify the white peoples as Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean. There has been altogether too much blending to permit such a grouping. At one time, there was a fairly well-defined division of white race into such classes, but widespread intermingling has since occurred, and it is no longer possible to identify these distinctions with any clarity. Even in 3000 BC, the ancient social groups were no more of one race than are the present inhabitants of North America.
All right, so obviously, see, that paragraph is speaking to what the Revelators knew was, developing in the 20th century. Got way abused. So, no, there isn't anything extremely definitive about Nordic, Alpine, and Mediterranean. Or if you want to kind of speak in more abstract terms, there's not really a fact to those three races, but there's a truth to those three races. Right? There's a definite truth. Right? There is a basic, historical factual predicate. You go back to 3000 BC, sort of like when it was finally set like that, and even it was set like that, it was already unraveling. Right, it was sort of just a passing moment when you had kind of three, and immediately they were blending together. They said up there, ever since remained characteristically Alpine. It's not like this is devoid of validity. And then remember other issues, the diversity of individuals in a given race, right? I mean, everything has bell curves to it, right? I mean, you know, all of the just the individual genetic issues. Like I was pointing out, you take all of those Northern Europeans, and on the one hand, you might say, oh, they're more directional than other peoples. Well, yeah, but in amongst themselves, there's a whole spectrum from very directional peoples to very place-like peoples, right? There's always the two tails of the bell curve, right? So you've got very place-like lily white skin people and very directional like lily white. You know, you can't just look at the skin color and know whether or not they're genuinely leaning into the future or not.
On the other hand, there is a place in the book where it says how groups of similar thinking people come together in mutual pulls.
Right, we naturally gravitate into like temperament groups. Yeah. And one other little thought, then we can read the last paragraph. Let's say you have two lily white, very place like individuals. It doesn't mean that all their children are going to be place-like, right? One of their children might be quite directional because, see, right? You can judge that by their skin color. There's a potential that some generation from those two, there's going to be a directional person that's going to come out of that, because the potential is obviously there. But, it might not be actualized that the person you're looking at, right, they may be very place-like. I mean, they may be hopelessly place-like than some secondary sanguic. You can find some secondary sanguic that's a lot more directional than some lily-white Northern European guy, right? Because, again, there's, the diversity amongst the groups. But, obviously, kind of the whole point of the United States was to take the more directional people from all over the planet, no matter what their skin color was or, ethnicity or whatnot, and pool the more directional people here. They had to leave their place to come here. It kind of just is naturally inherent in what we are. We aren't a people that evolved in place here like everyone else on the planet. So naturally, right, there's going to be, you're going to kind of just naturally pool the more directional people here. And then you'll see they're going to, that's where they end up, the final paragraph.
This European culture for 5,000 years continued to grow and to some extent intermingle, but the barrier of language prevented the full reciprocation of the various Occidental nations. During the past century, this culture has been experiencing its best opportunity for blending in the cosmopolitan population of North America, and the future of that continent will be determined by the quality of the racial factors which are permitted to enter into its present and future populations, as well as by the level of the social culture which is maintained. Presented by an archangel of Nevadon.
Yeah, so where does it end? Exactly with the present moment. The exact things we're arguing about today. Right? Okay, and they knew exactly what we'd be arguing about today way back at the beginning of the 20th century when they were composing the Revelation. You can't believe that all men are born equal. You can know they're all created equal. They're equal in the eyes of the Creator, spiritually equal, right? Equally loved, but they're not born equal. And if you start believing that, if you just let anyone immigrate into the United States, you can kiss civilization goodbye.
That's right.
It's not going to last. It's just a genetic fact. It has nothing to do with hating other people. It's just a genetic fact. All right, there's very little Andite blood. And without that Andite blood, in general, you don't have a people that are leaning into the future. right, that can go from barbarian to semi-civilized. Yeah. And then on top of that, you know, not only is there a genetic predicate to, you know, to civilizable, but civilization itself is a choice, as they're pointing out in the very last, you know, phrase there, as well as by the level of the social culture which is maintained, right? You have to choose a genuinely progressive culture. Just calling something progressive doesn't make it progressive.
But it's hard to be patient in the evolution movies. We just want this, some people want change and they want it now and they want everything different. They don't want to abide by the law and they want to just...
Of course, right. There's all these, anyway, we know there's all these issues, but you know, the revelators here are just trying to say, okay, you've got to clear your heads if you're going to have, if you don't want to, if there isn't going to be an interregnum. If you don't face facts and adjust them to ideals, you're not going to have the wisdom to maintain civilization. Civilization naturally collapses. There's nothing natural about civilization. Right? It's artificial. It's an art form. And it has an inescapable genetic predicate. There are not many civilizable people on the planet. Innately. You know, they aren't self-civilizing. There's very few. And, you know, most are quite place-like, so they're just, they're not going anywhere. civilization is a going somewhere phenomenon. And so there it is. I mean, one way or another, we either find the courage to face these genetic facts and these responsibilities of civilization. You know, you have to recognize you have a personal responsibility to maintain civilization. You have to exercise the proper self-control for civilization to be ongoing. It's not going to be naturally ongoing. If you do what comes naturally to you, you will be disrupting civilization. And all of that unnaturalness that leads to civilization has a nucleus to it. Genuine religion, not mere evolutionary religion, but genuine religion, is about being unnatural, right? As it stresses up in the religion papers, 12 different ways of being unnatural so that you can be genuinely religious. Right? That nucleus, there has to be genuine religion. Think about how important it is that the people that are trying to be very unnatural and really progressing forward into the future, how important it is that they see themselves as a nation under God.
They're taking God out of
them. You take God out, you take the nucleus out, you can, again, you can kiss civilization goodbye. It's not going to happen without that unnatural, real God nucleus. It's not going to happen predicated on mere goodness. It has to be godness in the nucleus. They tell you in paper 102, right? Goodness is not enough. It has to be godness in the nucleus. So again, we could go on for an hour, right? But just notice when all is said and done, that's how they end, right? It's like this is all immediately relevant, right? If you watched the news today, right? You saw this final paragraph. Yeah, so that's what, you know, this is a book that's not just about the religious nucleus. This is it's about the religious nucleus, but everything that radiates out from that religious nucleus to all of the gritty, difficult details of civilization, economics and science and immigration. And genetics, you know, even eugenics, right? Things that are so scary to even think about anymore because of what happened back in the 20th century that we're alluding to here with all the, you know, Nordics and Alpines and Mediterranean thoughts and whatnot. Yeah.
So,
So given the fact that we can sit here and recognize the situation we're in or the problem we're in, etc., and realizing that, you know, we all have a part inside of us that respects the God inside of everybody else, you know, it seems to me that the solution for the problem, you know, is not, given what you mentioned a minute ago, kill everybody who's not advanced, so to speak. But it has to be, it seems to me there should be, or could be, you know, we're not getting Adam and Eve again. We're not going to be able to start from the beginning again. Scientific solutions, eventually, that would help us to be able to, you know, in an intelligent way, upstep the races of mankind.
Yeah, definitely. Long term, we'll genetically upstep. There will be genetic engineering. But in the short term...
No, I understand that, but long term, you think we
yeah, will figure that out? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because we'll get help, you know. That someone is going to come and eventually help us. You know, Machiavelli, Ventimiglia, Melchizedek, or someone is going to help us with that genetic stuff.
Okay.
But in the near term...
It's not going to be
all we have to do is just what Adam and Eve did with the first garden. They didn't invite everyone into the first garden.
They built a wall.
They built a wall. Okay. Yeah. Right. But they didn't invite everyone into the first garden. They stayed in, you know, behind the wall in the first garden, and they went out to people. Right. Because we love everyone, or we should, as the Father loves everyone. Right. We're not going to stay inside of walls. Right? We're going to go out, okay? But there has to be a separation. You can't just let what happens naturally happen, because what happens naturally is it all blends together. Like we've said several times, you sit with someone long enough and you're going to mate with them. That's just the way it works. Doesn't matter who they are, okay? How turned off you are initially. Give it enough time, you'll mate with it. It's just the way it works.
Yep. Mention North America, the future in the continent will be determined by the quality of the racial factors which are permitted to enter.
Right, it's just right there. Like I said, I shouldn't have to stress it, but I'm just. But anyway, I mean, you know, everyone should, you know, see this, and it's like, yes, it's a difficult thing. It's a very politically incorrect thing to even talk about. It, you know. And there's some validity to the political incorrectness, because you can easily abuse these thoughts, as was done in the 20th century, right? The point is to go forward with these facts in truth and not in falsehood, not to reject the facts. The facts don't imply falsehood. It's in our hands whether we go forward in truth with the facts or not, right? But predicated on facts, it must be. Okay.
Originally, you get a lot of directional people pulling here way back in the day.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder what percentage of that is left to be able to bring things forward in the United States.
Well, see, that's the question in play. The revelators are concerned it's slipping. You know, because at some point there's not going to be enough directional people left to lead. You know, it's all going to just fall back into a go-nowhere place like state. That's the interregnum.
Yeah, the dark step.
Everything will grind to a halt, and you'll be in the dark ages for a long time until finally, slowly, the evolutionary hand gets a hold of the potential again, and there'll be a new renaissance. There'll be a new born again, right? And people will start moving again.
But up and have a renaissance from where, you know, where we
wouldn't it be wonderful? We didn't have to fall back, and we could. Wouldn't it be wonderful, right?
You're thinking that we're going to have to fall.
No, back. I'm not thinking we have to. It's just that the revelators are saying, one of two things is going to happen. Either you're going to go forward consciously from where you are now, or you're going to fall back, and evolution will eventually achieve what revelation failed to accomplish, right? Either we follow the revelation and do this of our own free will choice and we go forward, or we'll fall back, which is natural, and evolution over hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of years, right?
We already did this.
We'll slowly start it up again.
Yeah, they just gave us
if you don't want to condemn your grandchildren right, to the interregnum, then you have to choose. Right?
There are other things to choose also, like the technology getting out of hand, like AI.
Sure, there's all kinds of things we have to choose. Yeah, see, that's why the book doesn't just talk about this, it talks about all kinds of things. There's all kinds of problems with science. There's all kinds of, there's all kinds of problems. All the things that the big tech companies are doing is filled with huge problems, right? There's all kinds of big problems. But if there's no wisdom, right, we can't solve one of these problems, let alone all of these problems. There needs to be wisdom.
That just goes to show you it doesn't matter what the person looks like. They could have such degenerate genes in them that's why it's all happening like this.
Again, yeah. Anyway, we should wrap it up because it's getting pretty late here. But I hope all of you, don't just blow past this, right? I mean, you see it right there in black and white. Take it to heart. I mean, the literal heart, right? That reflective space in your mind, begin to at least not be so susceptible to the false teachings around us, right? And it's not that you're going to go out, change the world, but at least don't be a helpless victim of the antecedent causation of the ignorance around you.
I'm not.
Don't limit yourself to the ignorance of others. At least if one of us, each of us chooses to not be so ignorant, there's still some hope. But if we all just go along with ignorance to get along, right, then there's going to be an interregnum. All right, so let's maintain a world filled with hope here. Let's take a moment, everyone.